everyone, and welcome to So Mindful Podcast, where we dig into the tips, tricks, and topics that will help you have great fun making clothes that make you feel fabulous. I'm your host, Jackie Blakemore of So Much More Fun, and without further ado, let's get into this week's exciting episode. Hello, hello, my lovely listeners. In today's episode, I wanted to change it up a bit and to take you all on a journey back in time. When I was studying, one of the topics we had to cover was the relationship between fashion and society through the ages. It wasn't something I'd really looked into in much detail before, and I was surprised at just how fascinating and informative it was to reflect on past fashions and their links to our lifestyles at the time, to consider what has changed and how that has led us to what we wear today. So to help me on this journey, my guest today is my friend Paola DiGio of Mean Magenta Photography. And when we first met at a small business training course, we immediately found common ground talking about all things clothing and textiles. And since I knew that Paola had studied fashion history, I thought who better than her to help me share this topic with you. So welcome, Paola. It's so lovely to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Jackie. I'm so thrilled to be here today with you and your lovely listeners.
It's fabulous. It's fabulous. So our listeners won't know you. We haven't spoken before on the podcast, have we? So just for them, if you just introduce who you are and what it is that you do.
Sure. My name is Paola DiGiovanni. I'm a textile designer, mixed media artist and fashion historian. My love for fashion history started when I was an undergraduate at Salford University. In my second year, I studied history of design, and I soon got completely absorbed by the fascinating world of textiles and fashion history. So after I graduated, I moved down to London, and after my gap year, I decided to apply to the London College of Fashion, where I gained my MA in Fashion Studies. Well, during my time at LCF, I had the opportunity to study in depth fashion history from the late 1800s to the late 20th century. I'm truly passionate about the stylistic evolution of women's wear. And it's quite difficult for me to pick a decade because I just love, you know, all the different couturier from France and the evolution of style throughout the 20th century. Having said that, I would like to talk to you about the 1940s today, because I find that despite the war years, that's a very fascinating decade from the design perspective, but also from a social point of view.
Yeah, fantastic. I think that's a real great choice, because there's such a shift during that whole decade in terms of fashion.
Absolutely. It's a stylistic earthquake.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it was interesting, before the interview, you'd sent me some links, and one of the links that I'd looked at was leading into that from the 1930s, because that wasn't really a decade I'd looked at, because you hear a lot about the 20s, a lot about the 40s and 50s, and I kind of looked at the 30s as well, and you could see the trend as it's moving, like in the late 1930s, into the styles that we recognise from the 1940s. Okay, so let's start by talking about what do you think the key kind of features and signatures were of the 1940s then? Because it's quite a big decade in terms of the changes, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Just before the outbreak of war, the very last catwalks, both in France and, you know, throughout Europe, there was this kind of very romantic trend, you know, with loads of flounces, long gowns. It's very romantic and subtle and feminine. And then there was this abrupt end, and everything became very almost kind of too rational, too Spartan, utilitarian, very much influenced by the military style adapted to the female silhouette. But then at the end of the war, within 5 years, there was this coming back to the hourglass silhouette, you know, the usual stereotyped female shapes. And it was fascinating to see the extreme dramatic change from one opposite to the other, and the impact that couturiers like Christian Dior had throughout the world, both in Europe and across the pond in the USA. Mm. And it was a contrast from sheer make, do and mend and just making a garment last for forever, to this back to the opulence, the full-blown femininity, yards and yards of fabric for these amazing romantic gowns, and also the social tension, especially in the UK, and this kind of rebellion because women, despite the war, had this taste of freedom because they took on the jobs of many men because they were off to war. And then they were, in a way, segregated back into this usual female role of homemaker, mother and wife, also through the constrictions of fashion and the dictates of the silhouette, you know, feminine, wearing gowns while during the war, because of, you know, being working in the countryside or in the factories, they were using, you know, wearing more masculine garments, trousers. So it was a very fascinating contrast, this social and stylistic tension between, you know, the woman wanting to be glamorous, feminine, beautiful, desired, but also claiming back her own independence.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I hadn't appreciated until I'd started looking at it a bit more was the fact that there'd been very few women wearing trousers, for example, before the 1940s. You did see it, and in the kind of late 20s, a little bit through the 30s, with the quite full trousers and
beautiful,
and yes, that, yeah, beautiful kind of wide leg palazzo almost style,
yes, trousers. Yes.
But even then, it was still slightly frowned upon in society that women were wearing trousers. You know, you were seen as being a particular kind of woman for wearing that kind of outfit. And I think, as you say, in the when women had to start working in the factories and doing more practical land work and those kind of things, then obviously trousers became more practical, but introduced a freedom that I don't think women had had up really till that point, had they, in terms of their clothing?
Yes. Yeah, I think the palazzo trousers were beautiful and very glamorous. And I think it was a trickle-down effect, again, from Hollywood cinema, because I remember one of the movies where gorgeous Katharine Hepburn featured, and she was just showing off these amazing high-waisted trousers. But again, it was, you know, not for every woman from, you know, everyday wearing, you know, just that kind of very elegant trousers. It was more elitist. So again, I find it so fascinating to see the incredible contrast and how people try to emulate those looks, because cinema, especially movies from the US, was a kind of huge shop window for women to get inspiration and then adapt and scale down those very opulent silhouettes and emulate those divas from America.
Mm.
It's beautiful and almost that poignant to see how the so-called everyday woman, without sounding patronizing, how she wanted to carry on despite the restrictions, the ration goods, the limited access to certain textiles, to be elegant, glamorous. I think in a way most women saw that as a rebellion towards the impositions caused by war, the restrictions, and how the government wanted to control the appearance of the female body in a way.
And so I think one of the things that strikes me at the moment is we talk about being in a recession and the impact of having less money and people losing jobs and those kind of things. And some of those things were similar to having less money and having less disposable income, I think, is part of one of the driving factors through the 40s, wasn't it, in terms of during the war period. And so how do you think that showed itself in terms of the fashion, particularly during the mid-40s? How do you think that changed the fashion then?
I think on the positive side, because many people make this wrong assumption that the 1940s, especially during the war years, it was doom and gloom and women's wear was absolutely boring, plain, grey and unimaginative. But as I said earlier on, I think that most women wanted to rebel and just show their own personality and the willingness to be elegant and feminine. So despite the restrictions and the rationing, they just managed to dig deep and be creative and resourceful and very ingenious. Also because I think, obviously, in those days, it was a different social scenario. And women very early on, the young ladies and young girls were taught by their grandmothers and their mothers to sew, knit and crochet. So it was inculcated in them, that kind of set of skills that needed, they were going to need later on, because it was assumed that, you know, most of them will carry on having just the usual domestic homemaker career of a mother and so on. So it was expected of them to know how to sew, to knit, to crochet and to mend. So they had a huge set of skills, of practical skills they used. So I read, it was a very fascinating article about many women, many wives, once that their husbands went off to war, they literally went into their wardrobe, I mean the guy's wardrobe, and they just went on a rampage and literally deconstructed coat, suit, trousers, shirts, and basically there was this kind of literally reverse engineering. They deconstructed the garments and then they put them together in a way to create obviously more feminine silhouettes, day suits, coats, accessories, and it was a kind of, again, very endearing, poignant and inspiring way to see how women decided that they didn't want to accept also these restrictions put upon by the government and the circumstances because of the war and the restrictions. And it was fascinating. Once they went through the guy's wardrobe, they attacked curtains, net lace, and anything they could lend their hands on. And if they were lucky enough to get themselves some silk from the parachutes, they could sew knickers, underwear. And I've read of many ladies sewing their own wedding dress using parachute silks.
I think that came after, didn't it, after the war? But I know during the war, I think one of the things that I hadn't realised, that they had to ration fabric because they were using it for making parachutes or for making uniforms and so on. And so it did limit what anybody could use to make clothes. Yeah. And as a result, as you say, they were raiding wardrobes and wearing curtains and doing all kinds of clever and inventive things that that would give them some choice. Yeah.
And I seem to recall that rationing in the UK was on until 1954.
Mm.
And everybody was issued like a booklet and coupons, and basically it took 18 coupons for a coat and 11 for a dress. So everybody needed to, you know, be very resourceful and careful and mindful of what they had available to manage their own wardrobe because of this limitation of what they could purchase via coupons. So it was, again, the limitation and how they just, you know, managed to look presentable, stylish, elegant. And again, the creativity played a huge role, especially for women, just to add that little detail, that little trim, the little bit of fabric to add a pop of color to an otherwise too utilitarian and boring and grey and severe day suit.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the women's magazines at the time had lots of articles about that, didn't they? About how to, you know, how to recycle and how to embellish and how to, you know, sort of just
uplift. Bazaar and Vogue.
Yeah.
Just, you know, made sure that the message went out. Obviously, they were encouraged by the government and they just made a point of saying you've got to be beautiful, but you also have to be mindful of not making any waste. And you want to be look pretty because of the morale for the population, the male population. So it's a kind of the role of women, you know, also during the war. It's absolutely incredible. Well, maybe going off on a tangent, but I wanted to tell you what I read about France during the occupation and how fashion in itself became almost a weapon against the enemy, because often ladies carried messages to the resistance by hiding the written note in that very flamboyant, sometimes very flamboyant and colorful hats, or in the platform shoes, sometimes just flaunting this act of defiance and very risky act almost a few yards away from German officers. So it's beautiful to see these daring ladies going off on a mission, being glamorous in a way and having a fashion accessory as an ally to accomplish this mission. I find it incredibly inspiring and fascinating.
Yeah, being quite brazen about it.
Yeah. And then on a lighter note, at the end of the war, still in France, because of, again, the lack of, the limited access to textiles, even though the new government was very keen to kickstart the fashion industry, again, also to attract the American buyers, instead of having a full-on fashion catwalk, the government invited the best couturier of the day and decided to create a small scale in these 27 inches dolls, this kind of miniature theater. And it was set in a museum of decorative art, which is close to the Louvre. And they had, I think, about 100,000 visitors. And that was like a way also to gather, funds for the Red Cross and the victims of the war. So, that was a beautiful, really, really, again, creativity that was spurred on by the limitations caused by the conflict. But it was also a message of hope, how people are so resilient also through creativity.
And I think that's coming, I think that's coming full circle again now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In terms of trying to find new ways to do what we can't do in the old traditional way. So.
Totally.
Fashion shows and other things being done in with a new take and a new slant. It's kind of coming full circle, isn't it?
Because obviously now we're all facing together a different, even though it's very dramatic, challenge. But thank goodness we have the help of technology so we can liaise and create and communicate and bond and connect. So I think, there are different, like in fashion, I think there are different but similar cycles. So sometimes we the format of the crisis is different. The reason of the crisis is different. But the modality of how people react and adapt sometimes is similar. Often look back towards the past to feel inspired and to see how they cope with that situation. And I feel it can be inspiring and reassuring in some way, even as I said, it's a totally different scenario.
But like you say, brings out similar reactions, doesn't it? And I think, like you mentioned earlier, around towards the end of the 1940s, when the silhouettes went from being quite a lot more formal and utilitarian, quite a lot of wool being used from blankets and a lot of kind of heavier weight fabrics from curtains and upholstery, because they could use those instead of using the lighter fabrics that were being used for other purposes. We then went from that into what is probably one of the more famous periods for Dior, definitely around the rebellion almost against rationing by putting way too much fabric into garments,
yards.
Yeah, and I watched you sent me a link to one of the websites which had the documentary on about the Christian Dior from the V&A, where they'd got the suit, the day suit from, with the white jacket, the iconic white jacket and the black skirt. And she was saying in the skirt, there's like 5 meters of fabric plus the same amount of net. And it's got like a whole separate reinforced waistband just to hold up the weight of it. It's just
it was literally kind of almost an architectural structure, and the hips were padded just to enhance the silhouette, going back to the hourglass silhouette. It's amazing, as usual. I find that fashion is beautiful. It's like art. It's a kind of very strong fashion statement, very bold. But sometimes it's not very practical.
No.
It's artistic, but it's like a dream. It's an illusion. It's something that many women may want to aspire to, but it's a creative expression. It's this romanticized vision of the woman, but then it's the woman that needs to deal with the maintenance of the garment, the care of the body, and how she's showing herself, as a persona and as a woman by sending out this message because she's wearing this kind of very full opulent feminine gown and this kind of nipped in waist. And, you know, just it goes back to the male gaze, as I was referring to earlier on, just being seen and just, you know, just sending the message saying, this is how I want to be seen as a woman.
And I think some of the early 40s where women got a taste of working and a bit of independence and some of those bits. And then towards the end of the 40s and the early 50s where they're almost being reined back in, not only socially, but also by fashion. You know, I mean, you're back into the very small waisted, corseted dresses, you know, with big impractical skirts and underskirts that just mean that, you know, it's almost like a kind of, you've had a taste of it, but now know your place and get back behind that cuckoo, that kind of, you know, that sort of horrible scenario. But that, it does reflect that in fashion, yeah.
And I think it was a kind of deja vu for many women because that happened again, you know, previously at the end of the Great War.
Yeah.
So it was again a kind of vicious circle, you know, just women trying to, you know, break free from these social impositions and finding their own place outside the home, which eventually they did, but it took such a long time.
Because we talked before, didn't we, about the fact that then it goes in cycles. So we end up with, you sort of have the rationing in the sort of early 40s where you've got limited access to fabrics, but as you say, creativity comes into the fore. And then this opulence of lots of fabric in the garments in the sort of late 40s, early 50s. And then almost like the opposite, again, another rebellion almost in the 60s where we go into the mini skirts and the shorter, you know, more clean cut silhouettes of like Mary Quant and those kind of designers. And then through to the 70s where we rebel again and you kind of into big, you know, big expressions of clothing, big flouncy 70s flares and, you know, big collared shirts and all those kind of things. So it, you mentioned before, it goes through cycles, doesn't it? Of, we don't want to be like the last generation. We want our own thing, or we want our own take on it. And this is our way of expressing it, isn't it?
But it's so fascinating how this is like what I call it, the stylistic pendulum. It swings back and forth between these two opposites. And it's absolutely almost hilarious because it seems that we want to rebel against something. And then we want to go back to certain styles and certain trends. And then it goes back and it's kind of very dramatic dynamics. Yeah, it's truly fascinating. You're right what you're saying about the 1960s. And again, it shows how social tensions are expressed also through design and fashion and textiles. Because if you think about the boldness of certain patterns from the 1960s, really liberating. And I think they also, in a way, inspired the sheer, almost wackiness of the 1970s, because I think the 1970s, they went to some extremes in terms of patterns and combination of colours. Even though, having said that, you have also Laura Ashley, which is going back to a kind of more idyllic, bucolic, feminine style. So it seems that it's a bit schizophrenic. It seems that the two opposites want to coexist.
Yeah, and I think, like you say, some of the new designers that came through at those times were quite different, weren't they?
Yes.
In terms of their approach and also their backgrounds, you know, what their style was and why they got into it. I know traditionally it had been, again, and it still perhaps is quite heavily dominated by men in the fashion industry, I think, but you started to see there had been iconic women, don't get me wrong, but the kind of prevalence was with the male designers, but you did start to see more stronger personalities coming through, I think, after you.
Well, my heroine is Coco Chanel, because she literally liberated women from the corsets. And I know there's certain designers, like, you know, other French designers and also Madame Vionnet, who wanted to show the female body in a different way. But Madame Vionnet was, in my opinion, an artist. Like she was a sculptress. She's a female body with draping and textiles. And it was a completely different take on the female body.
And she was an engineer, really, I think. I was looking at, again, we had to study her when I was back at college, and oh my goodness, the intricacy.
You so can't... intricate. Yes.
Yeah, and they were saying about, so she has a dress, I'll try and find a link to it somewhere to put in the show notes, but I was just so blown away by this dress that it basically, she designed it and in such a way that they, it had to come with instructions on how to put it on. Because it was all one piece of fabric that just ended up looking like this fabulous sort of Grecian style, beautifully draped dress. But, oh, my goodness, it was so complicated to wear.
She's up there among the very best, in my opinion.
Sadly, unless you, I don't think you hear her name often enough, because I didn't know of her till I went back to college, you know, and that's not a, I don't think that's a great testament to her skill and her talent, because she, you know, when I did find her, she's just totally amazing.
I totally agree with you also, because the same in my view applies to textile designers like Sonia Delaunay from the 1930s. Because what I find is that, bear with me if I go off on a tangent, but very quickly, I think that these fashion and textile designers have been so instrumental to be influential also for interior design from the first half of the 20th century. So in a way, they seem that these artistic disciplines are interconnected. And especially, you know, if you look at fashion magazines over the last, the last two decades, there's always been this kind of conversation going between interior design and fashion design. When you see, like, you know, mood boards and this kind of cross-referencing between interior design and fashion.
Yeah. And I think they started to promote that a lot more probably from about the, I don't know, maybe the 70s to 80s, where they started to include more lifestyle into the promotion of fashion. So it used to be that you would see the fashion model on her own against a stage or a background.
Yes, or a stage. Yes.
Yeah, very much so in a photo shoot environment, whereas, and I know it's still very staged, but it's much more about what's the lifestyle that the person who wears this aspiring to, as much as, you know, is it nice to wear? Do you know, it's that kind of, it's going broader about what am I saying about what am I wearing, about my lifestyle.
Building the buyer's persona, just this kind of almost fictional, idealistic people living in this perfectly designed houses and just, creating the aspirational.
If I buy this handbag, I'll be super rich, or I don't know, I'll have this nice car and husband and other things to go with.
Oh, but that's fabulous what you just said about, you know, the staged photograph, because, you know, perhaps in the future, I would love to come back and talk to you about the role of photography in fashion and how fashion was portrayed throughout the 20th century, because, you know, my very first love is photography. So I was in heaven when I was at LCF, because I could study the history of design, history of fashion. And obviously that led me to, you know, to study more in depth history of photography, fashion photography. So that's a kind of, you know, another whole universe that can be shared with you and all your listeners.
We'll totally bookmark that one then, definitely. I'll have you back to talk about that. Because I was quite blown away by going back and looking at, we got a chance to look at all the old Vogues and going back into like the 1920s when the Vogue magazine first started to come out. And it's amazing, you know, just going from, even going from some of the hand sketches that were in the early magazines to start seeing real people even, you know, that was... That was quite different.
The transition from the actual illustrations to photography, black and white and then color. And it's, and Vogue as a magazine was really instrumental to keep the fashion industry going and keep the morale. And even though the HQ was bombed during the war, they kept going. So it was, again, another kind of way to show the typical British stiff upper lip and they get on with it. It's like a kind of, I don't know, just a point of reference for women during the war.
Yeah.
Not just the aristocracy, because obviously, like, Harper's Bazaar, Vogue was a kind of, you know, for the higher echelon of society. Yeah. And then they still managed to reach out to the wider readership of those days. So, yeah, absolutely fascinating.
Just a couple of last questions then for to kind of wrap up with. So in terms of your study of fashion history, why do you think, and Why do you think it's important to go back and look at these things, and how do you think it feeds into what we know about and what we wear today?
Well, obviously, I'm going to be very biased because I'm an historian. I don't belong to the 21st century. I tend to be sucked in back into the past, and I just want to, you know, I'm just dreaming of someone inventing the time machine, and just that's why I just love watching the 1940s black and white movies, because for me they're just an amazing endless inspiration in terms of, you know, fashion design, interiors, and society in general. I think, as I mentioned earlier on, it's important these days to stop and take stock of what we have literally in our wardrobe. I think it's crucial to keep sane, to rediscover these crafts and the pride and joy that one gets from creating a handmade garment. Because I've got the feeling that, I hope I'm not the only one believing this, it's not about the quantity of garments hanging in your wardrobe. It's about the quality, the provenance, mm-hmm. and the story behind. And obviously it's beautiful. You feel different when you wear something, a coat or a dress, or some lovely evening wear you've created and you've sewn, because you appreciate what went behind. You sourced the fabric, you chose the right pattern, you took the time to think about the styling, what kind of design you wanted, and why you want to create this item of your clothing for yourself or a loved one. And it's about the lifespan of a garment. And it doesn't matter if you have to adjust it because your body changes. It's all right. And just like during the war years, something that started as a men's suit became a skirt and became an accessory and then became something else. The same applies to, just again, another movie reference, Gone with the Wind. Scarlett O'Hara drags down these green velvet curtains and she creates this amazing opulent costume. And I think many women in the cinema, they say, oh, that's me when I go back home and I'll just go on a rampage and try, you know, my hand at doing something really beautiful, bold and colorful. That, because if we feel happy with what we are wearing, it does make a difference. We just project ourselves as a woman in a different way. But it's fascinating what women came up in those days. I've read about using, you know, they used a cheesecloth and curtain nets, because these textiles were not rationed. And with them, they created nightdresses, tea town clothes, baby clothes. And I was really amazed at what I read, because they were encouraged by the government to keep their dogs' fur and spinning into wool.
Wow.
I know. So there is this kind of, obviously that pushes to a limit. It's kind of really extreme experimentation. But
that's again, a challenge. That's a challenge to all the dog lovers out there.
Oh my goodness, yes. And I thought, I hope no dogs was mistreated. But you know, it shows how desperate they were, how dramatic the shortage of material was in those days. And almost anything could be a source of material to create something. Actually, you know, even the government admitted that, you know, it was a bit of a far-fetched idea and only a few dog breeds were suitable, among them, you know, collies and sheepdogs. It's funny in a way what you learn as a fashion historian. Don't get me started on the wooded soles, and I don't know how women managed to walk in those, because after the rationing in 42, you know, because rubber was getting rarer to find, they had to find an alternative material for the soles of the shoes. So they had this kind of really heavy wooden soles for their shoes, and I thought, my goodness, that what they had to endure is almost unimaginable. As I said, it's really inspiring and endearing and really poignant. And I salute all those women because it's, you know, they got together, they were truly indomitable. And also through organizations like BMWI, the Women's Society, they wanted to do something for the war effort. And it was not kind of the usual stereotypes or just, you know, for the sake of it. They really wanted to make a difference and be part of this huge fight against the enemy. And I'm sure you know about this kind of knitting, you know, frantically for the merchant navy, for the army. And between 1940 and 1944, a lady, alas, I haven't got the name, in Cheshire, knitted 1,000 pairs of socks. So that's what I said. So it shows the, you know, how we humans can be so resourceful, creative, even when we think we are up against the wall, we can just come back literally with a vengeance, you know, because, you know, even creativity can be a very, you know, impactful way to make a difference and fight back against negative events and very dramatic ones as well, of course.
Yeah, definitely. I think it can bring out that spirit, can't it, in lots of people.
Yeah. And these days, you know, what, before the lockdown, it was beautiful to see all these pop-ups and craft shop organizing, you know, crafts classes and, you know, creative events, because I think there is a growing need also, you know, across the, you know, both men and women, but especially for women, I've got the feeling they want to reconnect with a kind of more creative side and be in a group and be together and connect and belong and be creative and share knowledge, share ideas. And after this kind of, you know, 1980s rush to the top of the career ladder, I think many women want to find their own creativity again, a balance. So be a career woman, but also reconnect with the more creative side of her life. And just, yeah, and I think that sewing and dressmaking, you know, quilting, anything sewing can be a very powerful, liberating and almost therapeutic way to strike this balance and also to discover latent talent, skills that some people thought they didn't have, but they just need to be rediscovered.
And for those who want to know more, that leads me nicely into the links that you sent me. So should we have a little chat about those while we're just
going through this?
So I'll put these links in the show notes, but there's some great inspiration here if you are thinking of starting to make your own things and you just want to see what kind of things came from the past and have some ideas about how fashion's evolved or how you might use fashion and those kind of things. So the first one is the Fashion Museum, which is in Bath. It's currently, or Bath, as they say down south, which is currently, I think it's currently closed until Easter, but their website is still really good to look at. And I got lost in here for about an hour. It's so much good.
I immediately go into Jane Austen mode when I just land on that website. I went there with my mum. We couldn't leave. We just wanted to stay there forever.
And there's loads of activities. Even the kids' activities are great. You can colour things in and print things out. I'd highly recommend it. It's fabulous.
It's a beautiful museum. Yeah. Outside London, it's one of my favourite venues in terms of, you know, fashion history. It's beautiful, really inspiring.
So I totally recommend going to have a look at that. And then I'm going to pronounce this completely wrong, but the Palais Galliera, that website blew me away. I mean, there's loads of very historic kind of costume stuff in there. And I was really intrigued by some of the shapes of the garments and looking at some of the detail. If you want to add something different to your designs, then this is a great inspiration to kind of find slight tweaks that you can make or different shapes that you can adopt. And I absolutely loved it. So,
also because there are different subsections about photography, accessories, you know, contemporary fashion, haute couture, goes back to the, like, you know, 18th centuries. And as you said correctly, you can spend hours and hours and hours. And, you know, when we can finally, you know, get back our freedom to travel, I think it's, for me, it's the number one destination. And it's I think to visit this museum properly, you need to allow a whole afternoon.
Yeah. And then one of my favorites, which is the V&A. So the V&A website. I love the V&A anyway.
I was a postgraduate. The V&A was my second home.
I bet. And I still go. So if my friend Natasha's listening, thanks to her, I got to see the Dior exhibition and the Mary Quant exhibition.
Amazing. So, yeah, textiles department are really packed with beautiful, beautiful, inspiring designs. So we're really spoiled for choice. Again, a whole afternoon, ideally a whole day.
And they've just got such a large collection. But I also really like that, I'd like to point people to, they've got some highlights from some, like I said, I saw the video on there for about the Dior suit. And so it is definitely worth going and have a look there, because even when we went to the Balenciaga exhibition, they have little videos there behind the scenes and things like that that are really, really interesting.
Educational, the behind the scenes videos are so important, really crucial. And the V&A is fabulous also for the temporary exhibitions.
Keep an eye out. Yeah, because they tend to run them for 6 months, don't they? Six to nine months, depending on, I mean, obviously slightly different at the moment, but they have some fantastic fashion-based stuff in there as well. And then the YouTube, so you've sent me a link as well for some vintage fashion videos, which are just fabulous.
I stumbled onto this link quite by chance, but because I'm a very visual person, sometimes I do prefer to watch fashion and just, you know, as I said, you know, I do appreciate what goes into the construction of a garment by actually seeing the behind the scenes. But if you sign up to places, to websites like Chanel, they understood that people want to see more of the behind the scenes and, you know, how a collection comes together. So just Google on YouTube or just search. And you know, these days, thanks to the internet, we're really spoiled for choice. And we really need to be conscious of time limitation, but there is so much valuable content out there. And if any of your listeners wants more information or links, I'm more than happy to help point them in the right direction.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, it's been brilliant to talk to you, Paola. Is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with?
I loved it. I can spend hours and hours talking to you with you about fashion, as you know.
it's such a big topic, and I'm sure we'll come back to it. And we'll definitely put something in about the fashion photography, because I'm definitely intrigued about that. So we'll do that. So if people want to connect with you, Paola, what's the best way to reach you?
Well, they can view my work on my website, which is obviously www.meanmagenta, all in one word, spelled M for mother, E-A-N, magenta, as in the color, mean magenta, all in one word, -photography.com. They can see my latest creative musing on Instagram, which is obviously instagram.com/meanmagenta_photography, or just Google Mean Magenta Photography, just all over the places.
Fabulous. And there's lots of inspiration on Paola's Instagram. She's been playing around with marbling, and she's been doing that on some fabrics, and it just looks fabulous. So if you're different textiles.
Yeah, it started as a hobby.
I remember us talking about it in the book cafe, weren't we?
It quickly turned into a different kind of, product range.
And they're beautiful. So definitely go and check those out and have a look. But thanks very much for your time, Paola. It's been great.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed our chat with you.
Fabulous. Well, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Check out the show notes in the description area of your podcast app and click to follow or subscribe. Or head over to sewmindful.com/podcast, which is sewmindful.com, where you can also sign up for an email reminder so that you don't miss out on any juicy episodes. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, then please help others find us by leaving a review if you love this episode. And I'm always excited to find out what you got from the episode and how you plan to use the tips. And finally, if you have a question, feedback, or a topic you'd like me to investigate, then you can also email me at hello@somuchmorefun.co.uk. So until next time, stay gorgeous and have so much more fun.